Thanks for checking out another Art of the Cut podcast. I'm Steve Hallfish. On this episode, we're talking to Dan Leventhal and Lee Folsom Boyd about editing Spider-Man Far From Home. Dan Leventhal, ACE, has been editing Marvel movies since the original Iron Man in 2008 and has largely edited Marvel movies since then, like Iron Man 2, Thor The Dark World, Spider-Man Homecoming, and Ant-Man. He's also edited Dead Presidents, Elf, and Cowboys and Aliens, among others. Lee Folsom Boyd has a similar pedigree of big-budget films, including three of the Fast and Furious franchise, Ant-Man, and Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. Lee and I spoke about that editing experience on a previous Art of the Cut. We talked over Skype with Lee calling in from London and Dan from L.A.
Dan and Lee, thank you so much for joining me. I went to go see Spider-Man Far From Home last night and loved it. One of the things that struck me with the movie was the sense of the personal side and blended with the gigantic VFX part of it. How much did you guys have to do to decide how much of the character development stuff you had compared to the other? Was that all scripted, or did you find that changed in post?
I think it evolved, right?
Right.
I mean, they had a lot of good stuff in place, and the first movie had established an awful lot about him. But as we went along, things did keep evolving.
One of the other things that struck me, just to come up with some discussion points, is some of the VFX are so elaborate that I was trying to figure out how you even... When you were in the early stages before the effects were delivered, what were you using to get a feel for those shots? Were you using pre-vis or
Yeah, we used pre-vis. And then, you know, our visual effects team was great. And they tried to get us, you know, keep stepping up the quality of the shots in post-vis and then temp comps as they could. So that really helped reimagine the sequences as well.
Yeah, you know, our first goal with the assembly is to just be able to tell a story. So they gave us enough of pre-vis, and then that turns into post-vis, which is they start to shoot the backgrounds, and we put that stuff in. But then at a certain point, all bets are off, and we start rewriting the whole movie anyway, and start changing the thing. And Lee certainly did an awful lot of that. You sometimes have to start the conversation by requesting something, whether it was planned or not, just to get everyone thinking about everything. So, we're going to have to do something here. So we may interact with the post-vis people or pre-vis even sometimes and say, can you do this for us? And then we'll put it in. And then once the director and the other powers that be come in, then they'll put in their 2 cents. But we have to kind of get it started.
Absolutely. You mentioned that you kind of rewrote or things changed fairly significantly. Can you remember, I don't know how many of them you can discuss, but is there a specific example that you could cite of, hey, this is the way it was written, and when you actually saw it as a story in time, it didn't work? What were some of those things that did change?
The action scenes definitely evolved the most, and Lee had the task of the gigantic end battle, it's sort of how it evolved is night and day. On my side was the illusion battle. You know, we have high ambitions, and so as the original plan, everyone felt was underwhelming. So then the Eye of Sauron goes on to that, and then we put all our effort into that, and then it moves to the next thing. So that's kind of how it goes.
How did you guys divide up though? You mentioned that Lee did the big battle at the end, and you kind of did the big battle in the middle. What was the breakdown of just stuff coming in during dailies, and who took what?
Well, Lee tried to take everything. Let's that's what she does. But that was great. She's like more than game for everything. I always have an interest because I go back. I'm kind of a story guy, and so I have an interest in character and tone. In our negotiation for who would do what, and it made me very happy to give her the biggest, hardest task. And because in my world, I like to kind of find the tone, find the story beats and the character stuff, and sort of try to get that stuff a little off the table. Because I figure if we get that early, it means a lot to what the rest of the process is going to be. So Lee took three biggest action scenes in the movie with joy and love and did it. And we help each other, though. She comes and comments on whatever I do, and I come in and comment on hers. There's, you know, between us, there's an enormous skill set, enormous amount of experience to be able to tackle the different problems as they come.
And we just had a lot of fun approaching the work. I loved the collaboration with Dan, and like he said, we were just able to hammer it out and get it done.
Mm-hmm. You guys have both worked on some big movies, and I am really interested in the thought process of trying to manage those or understand what it means to work on a movie of that size and scope. What are some of the reasons to hire one of the two of you instead of somebody that's worked on a smaller film in dealing with the volume or the VFX?
I suppose, you know, experience is a great thing, and they like to mix it up. So Lee already was a very veteran person on big pictures and effects pictures, so she's no stranger to any of that. I'm a Marvel veteran, in fact, the original Marvel veteran, because I did the first Iron Man. And sort of, I have a, you know, the knowing of what's going to be expected, how it's going to go down. And you know, this was Lee's first adventure, so I was kind of helping her along. There's a lot of have faith in the process. Don't worry about it now. This stuff will get there.
It'll get there.
And you know, we don't have a lot of pieces until late, you know, be it because of effects or eventually additional photography that makes things work. But we're editors, so we have to try to make with what we have. You can't go, well, this will be better later. You have to hammer out version after version, even if you know that this isn't going to be what it ultimately is. And sometimes you also need work in progress for other shoot, like Lee did this amazing bus sequence, right? And they had shot the interiors before the exteriors, and there really wasn't a semblance. So the script was kind of like, it had some dialogue and ideas, but it really wasn't the shape of what Lee developed it to be. In order to do that, there's this chicken and egg thing again, where you have to present something so that then they can react off of it. It's part of our mission. It can be thankless too, because that's wrong. Yeah. Let's now make it right by getting the stuff we need. So that's a prime example of a sequence that evolved to one of my favorites in the movie.
Lee, speak to that a little bit about how it evolved and what the process was of getting it from something that you don't have the footage that you need or whatever, or stuff's missing. What was carrying you through being able to get through that process?
Well, I think while it's evolving, you go through a lot of ideas. With the bus sequence, there were many times when I would go into Dan's room and I would be like, Dan, I don't know about this. You know, there's a couple of ideas here that I have an issue with, and he'd help me talk it out. You know, in the bus sequence, that's the first time that Peter Parker is putting on the glasses and he's introduced to Edith. In the MCU world, we know that any of the Stark tech is pretty spot on, right? And so to have Edith not work for some reason, that was an evolution as well. Like, what was making Edith not respond to Peter? And so that was something that evolved right up until the last additional photography shoot. John Watts, our director, said, you know what? We need a gag here to, you know, like the glasses falling off of Peter's face. Like, it has to be something that makes sense and that's not, you know, going to dumb down the sequence, but it has to be fun. And so that was something that kept evolving. And like Dan was saying, like, we had storyboards in there for a bit as it evolved, and we would throw that idea away. And just coming up with an idea that really would capture why Edith couldn't hear Peter, or why they couldn't communicate with each other, you know, that felt organic and not like something that would be unbelievable to our audience who have come to embrace the MCU world and, you know, all the gadgets and tech and stuff like that. It had to be fun, but it had to make sense, and it had to be organic.
To add to that, when we do these scenes, they're not shot in order. They're in isolation. At first, they're each their own movie, right?
Yep.
And the fact is that scene established the rules of what Edith would be. You have to then say, well, whatever rules you're going to put here now are going to apply to the third act. it meant actually looking at the strings that went all the way to the final sequence to make it all cohesive and to make it make sense. We had a lot of that. We had good sequences that we had, we made their own rules for whatever in that sequence. But then when you put it against the whole, it's like, wait a minute. I thought that Edith couldn't do, you know, could just do this or couldn't do this. And so you get to that point where you got to, well, we better go back and find a new way to solve the earlier scene. So Lee had to solve it about 4 or 5 times by the time it's over.
I think Dan at one point was like, I would kind of knock on the door and walk in and look at him, and he would be like, what? I was like, Dan, I'm having a problem here. But, you know, ultimately it all worked out.
You know, your earlier question, there's a kind of like the quote in Shakespeare in Love, it's a mystery. There's kind of a faith in the process you have to have, especially on these gigantic films that are just complete organized chaos. There's no one person in the whole film that actually knows what's going on everywhere. It just doesn't go that way. Ultimately, you get in the room and get everyone on the same page. But while it's going, you have to kind of just take a deep breath and have faith. So as Lee's therapist, that was a big part of my job is, you know, don't worry, this battle isn't over. We'll keep going and going.
You were talking about these discussions and the process and how it evolves. And I love that whole idea of process. But these discussions are not happening just between the two of you, right? These are happening with Kevin Feige and they're happening with the director. Tell me a little bit about either managing that relationship or how you guys were collaborating.
Kevin came out a few times. They had already done an awful lot before they even left Los Angeles, and mostly, you know, they're trying to get the big points of the story, but they're also trying to develop the action sequences. They have a whole department at Marvel called the Look Dev. So a lot of the imagination that makes them greenlight a movie is based on actual still images that these amazing artists make. And those then get sort of saying, well, that's great. This was a famous moment in the comics or whatever. Now let's evolve this into a story. So we're actually coming in later in the game. I came in a little bit earlier in that since I had a relationship with John Watts and that team, they brought me in to pitch the whole story very early before we started. But then we're kind of at a loss. We arrive and there's actually, it's like landing on a moving bus. So there's not really anyone, there's no time for anyone to necessarily explain anything to us. We just have to kind of jump on and get our own, you know, sea legs, get ourselves ready. Up until director's cut, there isn't really that many eyes on us. There's only eyes on things that they're worried about. The rest is us just going, okay, what kind of movie can we make with what they're shooting? And so that's what we did. And we had a lot of fun because Lee and I could go in each other and play off each other and look and talk about problems. And she could educate me with her amazing organization next to my messy organization. And, you know, I give her a few pointers on Marveldom and comedy and things like that. You know.
Lee, one of the things I wanted to talk about was you mentioned, oh, you know, this scene isn't quite working or there's some problem that you're having with it. How are you relaying those concerns upward in the chain, not necessarily to Dan, but because I'm sure that the things you would tell Dan, you would not necessarily tell to the director or to Kevin.
Right. I mean, look, the last thing you want to do is go off and panic everyone that something's not working and, you know, do a sky is falling moment. And rightly so. I mean, you only want to raise that flag when you really have an issue and then, you know, so there were a couple times when we would go to set and I would bend John's ear and say, for this moment in the bus sequence, what did you kind of envision happening? And he would say, well, I thought that this would happen like this. And then he'd look at me and he said, is that not working? And I would say, you know what? I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at that. And with that in mind, and I will get back to you. And so that's what I would do. I would say, you know, it didn't work, but let me try something else. Because in talking with him, I would come up with another approach or he would have insight and I would say, you know what, let me combine that with what I was doing and see if that will work better. So as far as like relaying any concerns upward, we were lucky because we really didn't have a scene that was like, oh my gosh, this is not going to work and have to go to anyone to say that. It was like Dan said, you know, have faith in the process. And when all the dailies are shot and you can come back to it, you know, however many weeks later, when you have the other side of the scene to really work it, usually the problems kind of worked out, or it was something that when we got deep into post, everyone thought, you know what, let's just make this better. It works, but we can make it better. And so let's put it on an additional photography shoot and let's just plus it. And yeah. And then the problems were mitigated in that way as well.
Yeah, my philosophy these days, it's really evolved over the years, is that we have way more movie than we're ever going to use in this thing. I also know that there's politics going on that we have to be careful about. The director's biggest task during the shoot is to make his day. He's trying to make his day. So if we come and we say, well, we're missing this and this, it means that he has to take off something else and he may not make his day. So I'm like looking at it, they have their own politics where they have to sell for the studio's benefit what's a completed scene and what isn't, and whether or not that's really true, because we would always go, well, where are the inserts? And it's like, okay, wait, he's getting them later. But he's going to mark this as a complete scene so he can do all that. And then you just kind of, okay, let's take a breath. And for me, the real problems actually never in these days involve coverage and things like that to me, because I always figure we either have a way around or he knows it and he's going to get it later. For me, it's if I'm seeing a character problem. I'm seeing this isn't working. Why don't you do, or actually what I prefer than what's not working is what is working. If you look at this and this is working, why don't you tone everything here? And so I'll talk about that stuff. And boy, this director is as smart as a whip, and it doesn't take a lot. You don't even have to finish a sentence, and he'll already have it. I just try myself not to be somebody who comes and rocks the boat. I think also that's from a lot of experience, you know, knowing that you can do more damage than good. You know,
totally. Get
I think
that.
There was an instance where I wrote an email to John. And I said, hey, what about this? And not realizing that we got it in dailies the next day. Sometimes it's not always on the call sheet, but you still get the footage. So to raise an alarm or something, like Dan was just saying, sometimes is not beneficial.
Sure.
And it's no reason. It, you know, things sort themselves out.
But I mean, that's part of having the editor cutting while they're shooting, right? Is to be able to raise those alarms. But I agree that you don't want to be the person that the whiner that is always asking for stuff that they don't have or complaining about things that are wrong.
Yeah. And there are the real issues, the juicy ones do get talked. There would be, we would have meetings that would drift up to the editing room where we could talk about really say what the bad guy's arc in the story is really going to be. What are we going to emphasize? Because going into the shooting script, it wasn't fleshed out yet. And it got a lot of it did get fleshed out in the course of principal. And that had to be done face to face. It wasn't something we could do remotely. Lee and I would talk about the issues incessantly. I would come to her and I go, it's just, you know, this thing, like, you know, she had in her big sequence, this thing that I suspected, and it took forever to come and rear its head for real, and then boy. But that's the kind of thing we're talking about, what everything is about while we're going. We even knew about the implications of our tag at the end, and we speculated an awful lot if we were really going to be able to do it because it was such a corporate decision,
right?
Things like that. So we're talking amongst ourselves, and then when it drifts in to us, the producers and director, then we'll bring up these things. But to me, the individual scenes and coverage is not necessarily what I want to spend the very little time I have with them about. I'm going to talk about story.
Of course, we're both story driven, but Dan is like laser focused on the story and always keeps the story. And, you know, like he was saying earlier, the movie is so big and at a certain point it has to come down. And so having that focus really helps to just say, okay, this is a fun moment, but it wasn't necessary. It's not story driven. We can lose it and it's okay.
Who's the next Iron Man was what I thought the question of the movie was. Or was there something you kept in the back of your mind that was that simple that you judged scenes against?
I don't think that, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but that, I mean, we never really talked about that. That was never the motivation. The motivation was always, how does this affect Peter and through Peter's eyes? It wasn't to answer the question, who's the next Iron Man?
Well, let me answer that question a different way, because sure. That was there. That element absolutely is there built in. What we face a lot, though, is scenes that are talking two different things or more, where you do have to slim it down. This scene is about how Peter feels about, you know, he's dealing with the death of Tony. So this is a big thing. How is he going to overcome? Who's going to be the next Spider-Man is just a manifestation of having lost his parental figure. Then the issue comes is that we can get scenes that are convoluted and have, you know, multiple talking points at the same time. And ultimately, you have to choose a lane. So to answer the question in the form of, well, yeah, you want to sharpen. If that moment is about Peter being confronted with who's the next Iron Man, meaning how am I going to replace my father figure? Whereas there's other questions the reporters ask. There's other footage that could water that down. Generally, I like scenes to not have too many functions because they'll sort of cancel each other out.
Yeah, I totally understand. I was thinking more along the lines of Peter's always trying to decide, you know, am I worthy to accept this mantle? You know, can I do it? How is it going to affect me? How is it going to affect my friends?
Yeah, that absolutely. Sorry, I guess my take on your question was more like, were we asking ourselves, like, who's the next Iron Man? You know, the illusion battle is leading up to that. It's like he doesn't feel worthy and he's never going to be able to measure up. And, you know, everything that he brings into this movie and, you know, having lost his mentor and just dealing with that in general, it's hard for anyone.
Sure. Dan gave you a lovely compliment about your organizational skills. What do you think Dan has learned from you, Lee?
It was a high compliment, but I'm at a loss because I feel like we both had some terrific support keeping us both in line in the cutting room with our assistants. And so, I don't know, I like to like color the mat a certain color if I've made a change or something. And so I lean on that a lot.
She's not saying is how messy my bins are, and how disorganized and finding things are like a needle in a haystack. So she's not praising herself. She's just not telling the truth about it.
But did you guys ever have to share bins? Were you only working on your scene and then there wasn't a lot of handoff? Or
we had some scenes that were handoff for sure. You have the bin settings and then I would just click to my bin setting and then it didn't mess up whatever Dan wanted to do for his bin setting. So
The hardest part was her room was set up in post-production to be the one that all the players would come in, all the jackets and stuff.
Now I get that.
So I had to go and
Lee is a
very statuesque lady. She's tall, and I guess I'm short and stubby. And so I had to get up on her chair. She has a raised table with a high chair, and I felt like a toddler climbing up on top of her thing, trying to reach over like a toddler, you know, the little cup or whatever, and work that way. And so, but you know, we'd have each other's settings on our machine for wherever we were and try to do it that way.
Dan and I had a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun working with Dan. And so, I don't know, we laughed a lot.
I'm interested in the fact that there was a specific room that was more set up to accommodate the director, the producers, whoever needed to come in and have discussions.
Least friendlier than me.
No, I think honestly it was John got used to, I mean, on the first Spider-Man, he set up his desk and his office and everything in Dan's room. And we called it the dorm on this one, or they called it the dorm.
Yeah, my room was the dorm shared with the, even though he has his own huge office around the corner, he set up a desk and a thing and hang out only in my room all day.
Yeah.
Except when he's working with Lee. So it was like, I had to leave a sock on the door to let him know not to come in.
Whenever you needed John, if he wasn't with me, he was with Dan in Dan's room. And so just because of that, it was, you know, the couch was turned a certain way. And so to accommodate John, and that's really what it came down to.
Yeah, but also the way her room was organized, when Kevin Feige and all those guys would sit in with us, it was the more comfortable place.
Another kind of switch gears. First question would be, did you guys start before doing previs? I've talked to a bunch of people that say, hey, previs editors, like from the third floor or something, they edit differently kind of than you may edit a scene. Did you guys come in to try to do previs editing before the movie?
Not on this one.
Have you done it on previous ones, Dan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have. I don't particularly like to do it. I do it at the request of the director. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm still a little old school in that I think the editor's part of their job is to not have any skin in the game, you know, to try to get the footage fresh and just evaluate, make our decisions based on not what the plan was, but on what's going to work. So I always find, especially early on in the process when they're involving in individual moments, I find that, well, that's going to make it a little bit more difficult to just see it for what it is. Later in the process, of course, we have to help plan very precisely what the reshoots are or additional photography is going to be. But during the initial phases, I'm not a huge fan of it, but if it helps the process, I'll do it. Begrudgingly.
And Lee, you were talking about trying to sell scenes or know whether they're working or not. And I always think of sound effects, especially in a movie that's got so much VFX or sometimes a certain genres. Talk to me a little bit about building out sound effects to try to get a scene working when you don't even have all the shots, maybe.
Oh, I think sound effects are great. Sound effects and music, of course, do help sell a scene because it helps with the rhythm, but there's a natural rhythm that has to work before you have sound and music added to it regardless. I will work in mute mode just to see if I have a rhythm right or if it, you know, the natural flow of the scene seems to be playing right, and then dress it up with music and sound, because we all know that you can really influence tone and pace if you have sound and music. Just to add a little more intensity to the scene, and you put a more intense or something that is a little more percussive music beat, just to get it a little more action pace. I'm a big believer in dressing up the scene for presentation, because I think it gives you the frame of mind too. Like when you want to show something to the director, you want them to feel like they've made a movie. And so dressing it up gives it a more polished feel as well. I believe in getting a good feel for the scene organically for myself, just to play it dry, but then definitely adding music and effects help it. And then for presentation, I think it's great. I mean, I think it's key, just so everyone feels like they're watching a movie and their intent is paying off. Mm.
Dan, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have no patience for, at this point, I just want it to, like, as quickly as it can feel like a movie. Usually what I do is I'll cut the scene, have, in mind some, music and sound effects. I'll only do key sound effects myself, and then I'll toss it to my assistant, and they did a mountain of sound before the sound house even starts. We have filled that whole, all those tracks with sound. That's the work of the assistant team. Lee did a lot more of her own than probably I did. I just get the things in place and say, here's what I need. Or my assistant's been around with me so long, she knows what I need. So it's like, okay, just toss it over. And then again, as important as anyone is our music editor. And like I said before, when we're first starting, each scene is its own movie. They're sort of in their own thing. And so you're cutting it like it's day in court. You're going to make it like it's the most important scene ever. And then later on, as it gets to it, as you refine it and you study, you just say, we don't need the beginning or the end, and maybe not the middle either. So, but they all get their full thing with all the sound and bells and whistles to see if they're going to make the grade here. So that old notion from way back of the rough cut with rough sound, that's a thing of the past. You can't show work that doesn't look like a movie. It has to look like a movie right off the bat.
Dan, when you're looking at a blank timeline, what is your approach? Do you use Selects reels? Are you just watching individual dailies as a clip after clip after clip?
There are a lot of schools of thought, a lot of editors, but I'm the impatient editor. As soon as I see something that grabs me, I jump in, because my view of the whole thing is that when it used to be, at the beginning of my career, it was still film, right? And you had to be very careful with film. It was, I would call film painterly, because every stroke was very important. You couldn't damage the print. Once we went digital, to me, it's more like sculpting. It's like clay. I always say, I'm going to look at everything, but I might start editing before I look at everything. So I know that sounds crazy, but I just go where, as soon as something gets me, I'll go in. And I cut from a strong point of view, which means that I kind of sometimes know what I'm looking for, and therefore I preclude a lot of footage right off the bat without really having fully examined it. Like, so they got a big wide here. Well, maybe we'll use it to get in the scene, or maybe we'll use it to get out of the scene. I'm not cutting to that damn thing during the middle of the scene. There's no reason to jump outside there. So I'm not going to spend my afternoon looking at your 20 takes of your super wide. I know that sounds terrible, but that's me being honest.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, so definitely not a selects person. Lee?
I started out trying to be a selects person, but I share Dan's point of view in that I get excited. I'll start looking at dailies, and then I'll start just like cutting it in. And then as I go back through the scene, then, you know, you're looking at more and more and more. I'll do selects for action beats sometimes, but I think I'm probably more Dan's school of thought. Jumping
selects
in.
Now can also be just markers, and I'll put markers on things just to know where they were.
Yeah, exactly.
And it sounds like with both those schools of thought, or with that one school of thought of trying to jump in, it's because you do understand that it's a process. And so if you make a decision on day one, you're not locked in. So why not just start?
Not only that, I always say, if you do the perfect cut day one in the assembly, all you've done is precluded that cut from existing. Because the world, this is a collaborative process that we have to go through. So I had to play a bit of a game with myself to not, as they say, tighten the lug nuts too much during the early thing. I'm very much aware of having done that before and seeing a movie go past its peak. I've had that happen to me. So what I really have to play these games of, it's really good for where we are right now. This is really good. And then I have to then put it aside, because I know that if things go right, when we get towards the end, there's a certain moment where you want it to just slam in tight. And Lee smiling, because she knows we had that exact moment where they were like, God, this thing's just not going to get better. And it's like, okay, here we go. And then wham. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like a fighting shape. I have to have this mind thing of where we should be when, rather than going right in to try to make the perfect scene on day one. I want to make a good scene. I want to make a playable scene that says it, but it's not exactly the most refined or efficient scene it's going to ultimately be.
Got it. Tell me a little bit about screenings. I'm sure you guys did screenings and you attended them. How do you get a sense, without even looking at the cards or the notes that come back from the audience or executives, you're feeling that, right? You're feeling what the audience is feeling. Does it change for you to be in a room with multiple people?
Lee, tell them about our task that, unfortunately, we couldn't do our normal screening task.
So because we have spoilers in our movie, we had to pull people that had seen Endgame for our preview, our little screenings. And so it was a small pool to be able to take from. The first screening that we had went really well. And then our subsequent screenings, you know, the number gets smaller and smaller. And so we had another one, and then we were, the execs and everyone said, you know what, we can't do another one until the movie Endgame comes out, because we need to be able to have a larger pool to take from. People have to know what the spoilers are from that to see our movie.
Core issue here is that these movies have to be made to show to audiences, and we were hamstrung. So the normal process would be to keep bringing in new, fresh audiences to do it. So we had an audience that, even though they hadn't seen our movie, they were kind of skewed, because then it was really in relation to, well, how does this fit with where Endgame is? So until that movie was out, we couldn't really readjust and do the screenings that would then help us help take it home. But screenings are incredibly important for this mass media stuff to see. We, of course, hang on every joke. We do. And then we record the audiences on those, you know, infrared surveillance cameras. So, and you get to know everyone in that little select audience. Oh, that guy's yawned again. Oh no, we're screwed.
But for yourself, when you're sitting in an audience, because I'm assuming you guys sat in on those screenings, what did you take away from those screenings yourself? Like when you're watching it for the first time with an audience, you go, oh, that moment lasts a beat too long. It felt perfect in the edit suite, but not, you know, in the cutting room, but not now. Are you taking notes?
I do. I'm the one that always has the little pad and pen, and I'm taking notes. And you get a stack of cards, so it's kind of silly for me to sit there and do all the notes. But I've done it for years. But yeah, I mean, you sit there on the edge of your seat, and as a joke comes up, either it's a clam or it plays, and you know, like we would give each other like the thumbs up, or you know, there was a moment in third act where when I was cutting it, I was like, Dan, I just don't know that this is going to be as funny as it should be. He worked with me on it, and he was like, this is funny. Trust me, this is funny. And so I was like, okay. And so the first time that we screened it, it got a laugh. And I turned to Dan and I smiled and I was like, okay, you're right. You're right. You know, you're on the edge of your seat to see if the joke that you put in, you know, are they going to find it funny? Is it as big as it needs to be, or is it too big and then it's not funny? I mean, they're very informative, but, you know, I get nervous sitting in the audience because, you know, early on, whether you've got the audience with you or if they're not really loving the movie, and because there's just an energy in the room. And so, you know, when they start laughing early on, you're like, all right, okay, this might not be so bad. And then, you know, sometimes in these things, it takes a turn, and then sometimes they stay with you and they appreciate the movie like you want them to.
Yeah, those things are crazy because you hang on a dime and then big decisions are made off this small little group that's seen this movie. A statistically insignificant sample size. But people are saying, oh, what? Told you so. The first act doesn't work. It's terrible. Get rid of it or whatever. It's like, hey, wait a minute, guy. You look at the last screening. They loved it. You know, so you have to look at it and take it for what it's worth. I don't take the notepad. I just kind of like to watch them. I'll smile if they're laughing, and I'll laugh if it's silence about my own folly of how badly this moment just played. You know, but then there's the other great stuff is to see when the twists hit, you know, to see if they're on the edge of the seat and stuff. But Lee's right. If you have a screening and it starts and they're not on board right away, you're like, oh, it's going to be a long night. And vice versa, if they're like right in right away, it's just, oh, okay, here we go.
When the screenings go bad, you also know you've got your work cut out for you for the next couple of weeks, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. But, the strange, though, because these are scored things, and I've certainly had it where you go, oh, this audience isn't enjoying it. And then the score comes back and it's higher than the other ones. And you're like, what? And you have to kind of go by both of those things. You have to go by what you felt in the room, but you have to go by what they tell you on the scores. And then they beat you up with the focus groups. That's the other fun part. They start off, they're so pumped and they're so positive and, oh, it's great, everything's great. And then it starts turning a little bit, a little thing. Wasn't that guy's hair a little weird? Or what is this? Like, oh, yeah. And then, what was that all about? It's like, and then they start going, here it comes. So then you get this avalanche. And then that information is interesting, but it's dangerous, too, because then they hear this. If somebody was, like, worried about something, you could end up having to try it, change. So, but that's just part of the process. We go down alleys that lead to nothing a lot. As much as we're always advancing the picture, we're also sometimes going backwards on certain things. That's why you had to have enough screenings to then get to that point where you feel, yeah, that's it. We can put out this movie.
Sometimes, you know, the focus group, it does kill you because one person can really, you know, change the tone of 20 different people by saying something bothered them, and then they all get to think about it and they're like, yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, that's the takeaway.
And they all love the movie. Now they all hate it.
Yeah, that's dangerous stuff. I want to ask you one final question. I've kept you guys almost an hour. I really appreciate your time. You've both been so generous with me. Thank you. Dan, you alluded to the fact that you started cutting on film. Do you remember your first nonlinear, I'm assuming Avid, but maybe not?
Yeah, the first movie I was the editor was, it was cut on this rinky-dink state-of-the-art thing. Back then, it was a poor man's Ediflex.
Mm.
And actually, the guy who designed it was this thing that chased a bunch of Betamaxes. You'd go, here's what science has come up with. You'd do a preview, and then you'd hear like 12 Betamaxes clicking to places so you could play multiple cuts. And it would go, you got at least 15 seconds of material you can watch here. That's where science has brought us. What can they do more now? So then by my second film, I was on an Avid. I bought my first Avid in 92. So I never looked back. But in those days, we also had the parallel film room. Even if we're cutting digital, we would have an film room with us, and we would be cutting the prints up and getting them ready for screenings. So we would still look at film, or we would go and, like, because the resolution wasn't very good, so you jump right on the Steenbeck and look at the film.
So 92, what film was that?
Actually, that was 93. In 92, I was a music video guy, and I was cutting on Avids. First film that I cut on Avid was a film called Dead Presidents that came out in 94.
Yep. Ali, what about you?
I've always been on Avid.
Spoiled.
I'm just always interested in that transition, because some people have just talked about nightmare transitions from film to digital.
For me, it became my advantage. That's how I rose so quickly in Hollywood, because I was on the cusp of that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been really informative and interesting and fun to talk to both of you. Congratulations on the movie, and good luck on your next projects.
Thanks for listening to the Art of the Cut podcast. I'd also like to thank Michael Zack, who volunteered to edit this podcast. Also, check out Art of the Cut on ProVideoCoalition.com for more than 200 interviews with the world's top editors. Thanks again to my guests, Lee Folsom Boyd and Dan Leventhal. I'm Steve Hallfish. I hope this podcast gave you insight into the editorial process of filmmaking. If so, make sure to tell a filmmaking friend about Art of the Cut, and follow me on Twitter, @SteveHallfish.